now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from class to culture and the cheese in between. The movies are B, Darren Heyman is grade A, and I am your host, Jason Giaconetti, my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Good morning, Jason. Today, it's hard to believe, but we're going to go back 70 years for The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and I was 6 years old when I saw this movie. I just can't believe it.
All right, and we'll get to it right after this.
Science couldn't explain it, but there it was, alive in the deep, deep waters of the Amazon. A throwback to a creature that had existed 100 million years ago, immensely strong and destructive. A woman's beauty, the bait that brought it out of its lair. See underwater thrills never photographed before. See titanic underwater battles never dreamed of before in this most terrifying of the science fiction adventures.
Creature from the Black Lagoon was released, it debuted February 12, 1954, with a regional openings March 5th, with an 80-minute running time. Your director, of course, is Jack Arnold. Jack Arnold, you've heard us talk about here before. Movie like Tarantula, The Incredible Shrinking Man, It Came from Outer Space, stuff like that, which he was well-known director of many science fiction movies during this time that had a very distinct style to them. He would go on to be nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary Features, and then he was awarded in 1985 the President's Award for the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films. Your screenplay is Harry Essex and Arthur Ross, with story by Maurice Zim, produced by William Aland, of course, produced things like This Island Earth, It Came from Outer Space, Tarantula, Deadly Mantis, Mole People. You've heard that name before. He worked very often with Jack Arnold. The pair together went on to create a lot of movies that during the B-movie era were ones that stood out. Your stars here are Richard Carlson, who we know we've seen in many different movies, Julie Adams, Poughkeepsie's own Richard Denning, Antonio Moreno, Nestor Pavia, Whit Bissell, and then, of course, Ben Chapman and Rico Browning, both playing the creature in different parts. Your box office is an approximate $1.3 million. And I don't have anything about production, but we know that this was all shot on the back lots of Universal, which is really amazing. So Kelly was sitting with me watching this, and I said to her, and I feel like I feel horrible because Kelly doesn't know any of these things, and I'm not trying to like mansplain things to her, but she doesn't know. So I'm like, look at this. She goes, uh-huh. She goes, I've seen Creature Black Lagoon. I go, well, one, we were watching it in 4K for the first time, so the depth of field was crazy, like how crisp everything was. I go, this is when we're going to be able to tell if it's not real. She goes, what do you mean? I go, this is a backlot in Universal. She goes, are you kidding? Like, she didn't know that's a backlot. Now, for those of you who know what to look for, you can identify stuff because there's other movies shot in the backlot, and you can identify certain areas and trees and stuff like that. Even though they dress it up, there's certain things they can't overdress. But I said to her, wait till they go in the water. Watch how black everything is behind them. And it works to the name, the Black Lagoon, but it also hides the back of the tank because they're in a tank. They have to be in a tank. You aren't swimming in a lake. You're swimming ultimately, even though it's a quote unquote lake they have on, they had at Universal on premises, it is ultimately a tank of water that they're controlling. And you had to black it out because it's not nearly as deep as they would have you believe.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the one thing. When they talk about having to wait before they can climb out of the water because of the pressure. Yeah. I mean, how deep is a lagoon?
Well, yeah. But I'm saying, but they're trying to sell you on the fact that it's much deeper than it actually is.
But again, when you see it, I mean, there's a lot of flotsam and jetsam on the bottom of the lagoon that the creature's hiding in, and they're going through. I mean, it's very effective.
Yeah. Well, they knew what they were doing when they were down there shooting. Because again, Universal would use that back lot. I mean, tons of movies, right? Yeah. Kind of thing. And you would have parts where there's, you know, water effects and things like that. And that they would use that over and over again. But to kind of make it look unique to each film was the real key. Because what happens is if you know what you're looking for, you can watch King Kong and watch Most Dangerous Game, mm-hmm. and you can see things that are exactly the same, and you know, kind of thing. And that's not even like saying like you know, Kong's wall is what's burning in Gone with the Wind, but because that's, you know, just, you know, very. But it wasn't shot exactly the exact same place. It just was, that was the prop they were using. But for Universal, the backlots were used so often, and how they dressed those backlots up to change it from being for, instead of being a black lagoon, now it's the woods for the Wolfman, and now it's this for Frankenstein, mm-hmm. and now it's this for that, this other movie. And just so they could use that. And it allowed them, one, a way of making movies much cheaper than going to on location to shoot. Could you imagine trying to shoot this in an act? First, we have no control in a jungle. You have much more control here. You can shoot whenever. You don't have to like worry about actual animals. Because you notice there are no animals.
Not even birds.
Right. There's nothing. Like, they show you stock footage of them, but there's no animals except for the quote unquote dead fish in the water. There's nothing there. So it allows them to totally control that. But by showing you the stock footage, you get the sense that there are animals around and there's animal noises all the time and there's stuff happening. But it's a very, very controlled environment, which allows much more, better use of time to actually complete what you're doing.
Yeah. So one of the things that is obvious from the very beginning of the movie is that in the opening, there's a little science lesson that Jack Arnold, you know, introduces into a lot of his things to make what you're about to see plausible. And that's very effective. I've seen snippets of this a million times, but this is the first time I've actually watched it complete from beginning to end. And I said, this is a really solid movie for what they had, what their budget was, and even the actors. There's nobody's hamming it up, and it's all played out. You know, legitimately.
Yeah. So one of the things I forgot to mention here is so the music credits go to Henry Mancini, who won numerous awards, his 4 Academy Awards, Golden Globes, Grammy, stuff like that. And then you had Hans J. Salter and Herman Stein, usually we mentioned. And like I said, it's Universal International for your production company and distribution. All right. So the Creature Black Lagoon was originally shot in 3D. And was projected using the polarized light method instead of the red and blue method that would later be used. so they would get a where viewers would be gray polarized filters. And then that's more commonly used today, which is crazy because I think the fad for 3D kind of was dying out by 1953. So this is one of the last ones made there. Most projections of this movie were done in 2D just because it had to be done flat. It was done flat in 2D. In 75, they re-released it using the red and blue 3D anaglyph 3D format. And then that came out to home video that way as well. And obviously I didn't see it in the theaters, but Channel 11 showed this. I don't remember when. It was sometime during the summer. And I remember Luke and I trying to get to a 7-Eleven to get the glasses. Yeah. And we had red and blue glasses on, which if I'd known they're just red and blue glasses, we could have done that from any other number of things. But Luke and I sat here in the living room, it was a long time ago kind of thing. So we only had, we didn't have cable yet. And we had on red and blue glasses for the special showing of the Creature from Black Lagoon in 3D. And as you're sitting here, and I have them over my glasses so I can see the thing, right? And for those of you who have watched movies with red and blue 3D, I mean, it's 3D, but it's not like nowadays with like the polarized lenses and the like shot specifically for 3D in higher def and whatever. But it's an experience nonetheless. And as soon as when I told Luke that you and I were covering this, first thing he said is, remember we had to get those glasses? Like, it literally is, it's a core memory it unlocks, which I think for some people, if you were not the right age or you were too young to remember that, you may be like, oh, I would have loved to have done that. It is available on, I want to say the box set has it. One of them has it. One of the releases that, because they have the DVDs, the Blu-rays, the 4K, everything, right? One of them has the 3D version, but it's the 3D version with the polarized lens, like with not polarized, it's with the red and blue version. Because they could very easily make this a 3D Blu-ray and use your polarizing 3D glasses that hook directly to your Blu-ray player and stuff like that. But nonetheless, the fad of 3D, that the 3D fad that went there came back in the early 80s, for those of you who remember. Friday the 13th Part 3 was in 3D, Jaws was in 3 was in 3D. You had Coming At You. You had those movies that were 3D, was trying to make a comeback. And that's when they Universal was like, oh, we could totally put this out on VHS as that. Now, if you have that VHS, that's really cool. We didn't have that one. We had the Universal Collection with the painted covers, which are really cool. All right, let's get rolling on the movie. A geology expedition in the Amazon uncovers a fossilized evidence, a skeletal hand with webbed fingers from the Devonian period that provides a direct link between the land and sea animals. Okay, so that hand that is coming out of the rock there that they're digging out in the beginning, I've painted, I want to say, two of them, kind of thing. They are... it was a company years and years and years ago produced it, and then that company went out of business and whatever, and now it's being produced by my buddy, who actually produces a smaller version too, because not everyone wants a life-size hand in their house. But it's one of those things, when you start painting it, clearly it's the bone structure, and then it has the webbing, and you kind of are at a point where it's a black and white film, so you don't know exactly what color everything is, because as we know, in black and white film, if for something to read green to your eyes, you often paint it red. But the creature was not painted red. He was painted green. In fact, the shades of green were a little different for the land and then obviously in the water. The same way the suit was much lighter in the water, so Rico Browning could swim, so he didn't drown. And Ben Chapman had a heavier suit on when he walked on land. And the coloring was slightly different, but the creature himself was never painted red. Even though he reads green. That's mostly from the poster, which feeds your eye that it should be green. So you can see that. And expedition leader Dr. Carl Maia orders his two assistants to stay in the camp while he visits the Marine Biology Institute. Carl reunites with his friend and former student, ichthyologist Dr. David Reed. David works at the aquarium in California, but most recently has been a guest at the CALS Institute in Brazil to study lungfish. David persuades his boss and financially minded Dr. Mark Williams to fund a return expedition to the Amazon to look for the remainder of the skeleton. Okay, so David is Richard Carlson, and obviously David, sorry, and Mark is Richard Denning. So those, for those who have watched any kind of these movies from this time, Richard Carlson and Carlson and Denning both are in many, many different films playing. Yeah, usually they're not. I mean, they're not. They're usually playing scientists or professors or something like that. They're never playing like just normal everyday people. They're always playing somebody who's like educated or in charge or whatever, because it makes it very believable that they are that to the position they're in. And we also see Julie Adams at this point. Julie Adams at this point is like in her mid-20s. She's very young at this point. And again, she would make other movies as well, but I think this might be probably her most famous role of all time. So here we go. Soon after Carl leaves camp, an amphibious humanoid, a living member of the same species from which the fossil originated, becomes curious about the camp's expedition. When it suddenly appears and frightens the assistant, they panic and attack. And in response, the enraged creature kills both of them. So we get, this is, again, a very classic Universal kind of move. We see a hand. We don't see the full reveal of the creature, which you know, you're going to hold on to. You don't know what you do because it's on the poster, but like, you don't know what he looks like yet in the film, because as we know, what's on the poster and what's actually in the film might not look exactly the same. Universal was pretty good about making sure their monsters looked like what was on the poster, because you didn't want to, you know, they weren't lying to people, but the execution is always, you know, what's interesting about it. This is the creature winds up killing both the two assistants in camp. I think I say that. Yep. So the group goes the group goes aboard the tramp steamer Rita, captained by Lucas. The expedition consists of David, Carl, Mark, Kay Lawrence, who is we just said was Julia Adams, and another scientist, Dr. Edwin Thomas, who is Whit Bissell. Now, Whit Bissell, of course, usually plays a scientist or somebody who's a psychologist or whatever. He was in, isn't he? He's a psychiatrist in I Was a Teenage Werewolf. Yeah. It wasn't Frankenstein's Teenage Werewolf.
Yeah, all of these people, probably they were all stock actors for Universal, just like any other studio would have them. But again, I must say that the acting in this movie is believable, because the plot and the dialogue that was written for them makes sense. There's no silliness anywhere here. And you know, you just mentioned that they're on that the boat that goes into the Amazon called the Rita. The Rita is the name Rita. If you say that to anybody who knows movies, says, oh, that's the one from The Creature from the Black Lagoon. That name is almost as famous, and maybe even a little more so, than the Venture was in King Kong.
Yeah.
You know, when you say the boat, the Venture, everybody who's seen King Kong says, oh, that's the boat in the Pacific.
Yeah. Where am I here? When they arrive at camp, they discover Carl's assistants have been killed while he was away. Lucas suggests it was likely done by a jaguar, but the others are unsure because of how torn up they are. Now, obviously, no one is thinking at this point that there is a gill man that came out of the water from the Devonian area and is slaughtered two assistants during at camp. Further excavation of the area where Carl found the fossil turns up nothing. Mark is ready to give up the search, but David suggests that perhaps thousands of years ago, part of the embankment containing the rest of the skeleton fell into the water and was washed downriver, broken up by the current. Carl says that the tributary empties into a lagoon. Lucas calls it the Black Lagoon, a paradise from which no one ever returned. The scientists decide to risk it, and unaware, obviously, of the creature that killed Carl's assistants, who's been watching them, they head to the Black Lagoon. Taking notice of the beautiful Kay, the creature follows the Rita all the way downriver to the Black Lagoon. Once the expedition arrives, David and Mark go diving and collect rock samples from the lagoon floor. After they return, Kay goes swimming and is stalked underwater by the creature, who then gets briefly caught in one of the ship's drag lines. Okay, or the net. Okay, so they go down, and now this is what we're talking about with using the tank. Now, you'll notice that David wears two tanks on his back. Mark wears one tank on his back. Even though they had different color hair, and it's not that hard to tell them apart, they wanted to ensure that audiences could tell who was who going down there, so there was no confusion, because their motivation seems to be completely different from each other, and how they act when they're underwater is completely different from each other in future scenes. And then they get collect the rocks, they come back up, and that's when Kay goes for her swim in the lagoon. Now, this is probably, except for the look of the creature, the most famous scene in this entire movie is her swimming, because then you get the creature swimming directly underneath her upside down.
Upside down, yeah. Man, it's just...
I mean, Rico Browning is wearing a suit. Like, and again, it's a lighter suit than the one Ben Chapman's wearing on land, but it's still a suit. He's still swimming up actually underwater, actually upside down, and it's shot in a way so you can see her and him. It is one of the most famous, it is literally probably the most famous scene in the movie of him, especially when he's swimming upside down underneath her. And then many people would go on to notice the bathing suit she's wearing is nothing, too risque for the time, but it is very famous, completely white. It's stark. It gives you stark contrast against the very dark background of the lagoon. It gives you contrast against the creature. It's done specifically to make it look so it stands out, to give your eye something interesting to pick up. And as you watch the scene unfold. And then the creature gets caught up in the netting, and that's when they start yanking the netting down, showing how powerful the creature is as it's starting to break because it's attached to the winch, which, and so it's starting to break the actual, not bow, the pole that's holding the winch and stuff.
Yeah.
And it winds up tearing through the net, which is designed to catch fish, because they're trying to see what species of fish are living there as well, just so they can kind of get an overall, because if they're going to be there anyway, that's what he said, if we're going to be here anyway, let's just find out what lives here. So, which is a little foreshadowing, obviously, that they wind up catching the creature. Although it escapes, the creature leaves a claw behind in the net, revealing its existence. Now, of course, they said, well, we could have caught on some rocks, we could have whatever. And they said, well, no rock left this. And it's the same claw as they found in the, the claw itself is the same from the hand they found. Yeah.
And at this point, the tension really starts to build between David and Mark. Whether there's a little sexual tension, because Kay had worked for, or was working for Mark for a long time, and nothing seemed to generate there. But she is definitely David's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And you can see as the scene, they start to build, little by little, you can see that this relationship between David and Mark is being strained.
Yeah.
And yet the goal now that they're going to find this creature and bring it back alive seems to overshadow the tension a little bit, but it keeps building and building.
Yeah.
And they actually change their positions as to whether or not they should kill it, bring it back alive, or let it go. And so you don't really know where this thing is going to go, but they're still going down they're still trying to get the creature one way or the other.
Yeah. The problem is that David's motivated by science and wants to do
right.
Wants this to be for scientific research, it'll advance science, whatever. And Mark, even though he's technically a scientist as well, he's worried about the money aspect. He goes, do you know how much money this would make us? You know how rich this would make it's, and it's not about, I mean, it would bring the Institute all this fame, all this money. And he keeps reminding him how much things cost. Like, it's just not free to do this. This costs a lot of money to do this. And he's, because that's his job, is to be the money man in this whole thing, where I'm sure they would like to have left him behind. He certainly wasn't being left behind off of an expedition to look where they're going to spend a bunch of money to look for whatever this fossil might have been, thinking that this fossil, if they had found it all, would wind up being a great coup for the Institute and would bring people in.
Yeah. The way the movie is, it's just a typical movie. You don't see the creature right away. You see the hand, a full view of the hand. But you can always tell the creature is coming, because it has its own theme, and it boom, right? And then you know the creature's, you're either going to see the hand or you're going to hopefully see the creature. Now, about 25 minutes in, the plot of the movie is well laid out. You know that there's a creature. You've seen the real hand. And then you have a very short, maybe about a split second view of the front of the creature, head right in his torso. And that then shows you, and it's full. It's not, it's there, but you've never seen him before. There he is.
Yeah. So, so after subsequent encounters with the creature claim the lives of Lucas crew members, it attacks Kay and abducts and attempts to abduct her, but is captured and locked in the cage. Okay. So all that happens. So it winds up trying to come on the boat. Now it wants to, its sole purpose is not to kill everyone. It's just to try to get Kay. And what winds up happening is, winds up killing again the crew members. It kind of comes on the boat, and then that's when they see the footprints on the boat, they whatever kind of thing, and they're trying to figure how they could possibly capture him. So they try to use rote note in the water, and that's when all the fish come up, and then they think, well, maybe it's not going deep enough, so they start dropping loaded pellets all the way to the bottom.
Yeah,
and that's
called,
when you
call rote note.
Rote note, right? Yeah, rote note. Yeah. Yeah. So what happens is that now gets the creature drugged enough where now when they encounter him, this is when they're like he collapses into he's walking, then collapses into where there, which shows that there's a deeper part of this. The lagoon now has so they go and explore that, where they go through
the cave,
however, the opening, the underwater opening. And that's when the creature winds up trying to grab Kay, and one of Lucas's men comes to fight the creature off. Now, that scene originally, which changed, the creature just chokes him and then kills him, like crushing his head. Originally, the creature picked him up and threw him. The problem was, every time they pick him up, go to throw him, the wire kept snapping, so people were going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. So they tried it 2 or 3 times, said, nope, we're just going to change it, because they wanted to show the creature's immense strength, and was to pick him up and throw him. Remember, is it the original Frankenstein? One of the Frankenstein movies, where he throws like the big piece of equipment, and you can kind of see the wires carrying it there. The problem was, the equipment probably didn't weigh as much as the guy did, and they're trying to do the exact same effect. They wanted to have him picked up and thrown through the air as if he was like, he weighed nothing, and the wire kept snapping. So I think it actually works better that the creature doesn't pick up people and throw them around. I think it works better that he's just mauling them the way a creature would maul them, you know, kind of thing. Like he's just, you know, crushing them and whatever. Where are we here? So they able to capture him. So now they have him locked down in a cage on the Rita. And as much as they think that this is secure enough to do this, it just seems like you have to know this is not strong enough to hold this creature. Like it's made of like bamboo, like in wood. Like there's no way this is strong enough to hold him. Especially since you're not still drugging him. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, you would think that they would have...
Keep drugging him. Right? And if you're, I mean, it's a long way back. I get that. But, and my question was, how are they going to get him off the Rita? Like, they had to get on the Rita somewhere. They didn't take the Rita from the Institute. I mean, that's a boat that goes upriver. That's not a main, like, cruise thing. Like, how are they going to get him there?
Yeah, it's like a fishing boat.
Yeah, well, right. No, I know, but I'm saying, but it's like a barge. It's not like it's not a boat that's going to be traveling the high seas. I'm just, it's like, but how are they going to get him off the boat? Like, are you going to like, well, hop in there, Doc, let's wrestle this guy. Like, that's what I'm saying is, it just seems like they don't think they had this all planned out. Obviously they didn't plan to be there, but I'm like, exactly. They got him, but how are you going to do this? So the problem is Mark always said, he goes, you know, don't kill him. Well, we want him alive. Like, I don't know if Mark was wrong for hitting him with the butt of the gun. Like, I'm like, that dead might have been better for them. You just kind of like keep him on ice and get him back to, you know, so doesn't smell, you know, kind of thing. Get him back there, because I don't know what you're going to do once we get him there. You know, it's like you got the tiger by the tail. Now what? You know, kind of thing. Yeah. So, but it didn't matter, because the creature is not willing to hang out long anyway. Because on Whip Bissell's characters, Thompson is talking with Kay. And it's funny because, and he goes, and for another thing, and that's when the creature smashes out of there, and you're just like, good Lord, is he going to just start like, you know, bantering on? Because they're talking about the relationship between Mark and David,
right,
and how you know, Mark has to look at things financially, and David is a scientist who's looking at things just from pure science aspect of things. It's one of those things that as you, you know, it makes sense what's happening, but then the creature breaks out of there. And the whole idea is that now its entire goal is to just get Kay in and get away. And of course, you know, he's, where are we here? Sorry. Where am I here? During the night, it escapes and attacks Edwin, who was guarding it. Edwin smashes the creature with a lantern. It dives off, but is severely injured. Following the incident, David decides they should return to civilization. Mark, who's obsessed with capturing or killing the creature, objects. As the reader tries to leave, they find the creature has blocked the lagoon with fallen logs. While the others attempt to remove the logs, Mark is mauled to death while trying to capture the creature in a single-handed underwater. Okay, so they're going to go under, and they're trying to use rote note in a pressurized
spray gun.
But Mark also has a harpoon. A spear gun, he calls it. It is called a harpoon, right? And the whole idea is that they're going to either kill this thing or drug this thing so they get out of there. Now, look at what the log looks like on the top of the water, and look what it looks like under the water. It looks like an entire, not a log, it looks like a tree under the water, because obviously that's, you know, it's the whole idea of like, you know, what you're only seeing the top, like one fourth or whatever of the.
Yeah, it's almost like, almost like an iceberg. Iceberg,
exactly. So, but it's blocking their path and they can't get out. And they can't get in the water to get it out because the creature's in the water.
Yeah. Now, yeah. Mark has used that spear gun twice. The creature has been shot, actually been shot twice. Once early on and then at this juncture.
Yeah.
And yet you actually see him pull the spear out of his body.
Yeah.
But no blood comes out. At least you don't see any,
yeah,
any
well,
traces of something. But he actually pulls the spear out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also underwater and it was shot in black and white against a black background. It would be so minuscule for what you could see time. It wouldn't make sense to even waste the time on the
effect. Right, but that you see that because of the creature, this is the second time the creature's been shot. The first time it's in the back and he was shot in the back. And, you know, you say, well, how did, you know, what did he do? I mean, wasn't he hurt the first time? And it shows that even the spear gun,
can't really pierce can't really his hide, yeah. So
and you see him pull it out. Now, one of the scenes earlier, a little bit earlier in this, when he breaks out of the cage, is that the Whit Bissell's character throws
the lantern.
Who's in that suit?
Yep.
It goes on, and then he jumps into the water. That is really, really well done.
Yeah, it's a full body. It's a full body immolation. Again. Anybody who listens to The Vault knows that I always point things like that. I mean, it's a big deal to get yourself set on fire, even if it's only for a couple seconds. It's still that your entire body's engulfed in fire. And then to literally jump directly into the water, doesn't necessarily mean it all goes out either. You could still get really burned from there. So obviously they had to make sure that the person was okay. Nowadays you would have people with fire extinguishers and everything, like literally hosing you down. Here the person just jumps in the water. So Mark is mauled to death while trying to capture the creature they're fighting underwater. The creature then climbs aboard the Rita and approaches Kay from behind. She screams as the creature grabs her and takes her away into the cavern lair. So he grabs her and he dives off the boat with her. So, again, I don't know if that's Ben Chapman or Rico Browning or just another stuntman. Well, Ben Chapman, it could be Ben Chapman. But it probably most likely is going into the water is the lighter suit with Rico Browning in it. He literally is holding another human being and dove off a boat, which is impressive, into the water. You know, it's no small feat. David, Lucas, and Carl pursue them, rescuing Kay and riddling the creature with bullets. It retreats into the lagoon while its body sinks into the watery depth. Now, he goes in there, and now David is fighting with the creature, and then you have Lucas and Carl shoot the creature. And again, now they don't just keep shooting him. He says, let him go. But the thing is, and this is where the difference is, where here, Mark would say, no, keep shooting him. Let's kill it and let's take it back with us. David lets it have, it gets shot and it's trying to walk off to get back to the water. He lets it go to the water, which really changes things because if you shoot and kill it, there is no sequel, right? Because you can't bring him back from the dead. He's not, you know, kind of thing. But it allows him to fall and he just starts floating down. And your assumption is that he's now dead because he's completely still as he's falling. But what winds up, we know, happens, because there are sequels to this, is that it must survive and then come back. But what happens now in this point is we've now established what the creature looks like. We've now established where it is. We've now established a very easy, because you can have the exact same sets be used a second time if they're going to go back into the Amazon to look for them. You don't have to change sets. It's not like it now needs to move locations, because it literally can be done in the exact same place. Now, for those of you who have seen Revenge of the Creature and know all about climbing up and down ladders, you would know that they do, in fact, go back to the Amazon to try to capture the creature, and then they do other things to get them there. And then the creature walks among us later on. You would then have the creature back again, but that time's when they start trying to remove his scales to find that there's lungs underneath there, trying to link it as being the missing link between the land and humans. So this movie is, again, Leonard Maltin said it was one of the archetypal 50s monster movies that that's been copied so many times before. It's literally one of the highest rated out of all the universe. And again, the Universal Monster movies are held in high regard, but this is the one of the later ones. And usually at this point you were getting into sequels, and the sequels were just starting to run out. Now you're getting to have a Costello. Like, this movie was the Creature from the Black Lagoon has been ripped off and redone and retold hundreds and hundreds of times. And it's actually made the AFI Top 100 Thrills. It was nominated for that. And it's the Gill Man was one of the nominated villains for the 100 Heroes and Villains. There was obviously a sequel, Revenge of the Creature, in 55, which was also released in 3D, hoping to bring back the full format. And then Creature Walks Among Us in 56. Abbott Costello would have on the Colgate Comedy Hour a parody with it. And that's known as Abbott Costello Meets Creature in Black Lagoon, which is a little short one. In 82, John Landis wanted to try to get Jack Arnold to direct a remake, but that all fell apart, especially after the Jaws 3D did not do anything. In 92, John Carpenter was developing the remake for Universal, and he actually had, he invited Rick Baker, was hired to do the 3D models of the creature, but it never got greenlit. You had, in, as of late as 95, it was offered to Peter Jackson. This is all prior to, you know, 90, he was offered to him as late as 95. He kind of considered it, but then said, hey, you know, I want to make King Kong. So he makes King Kong instead, which took years to make. Ivan Reitman in 96 went on to, like, let's make a remake of this. After The Mummy, Stephen Sommers' The Mummy, there was talk, well, why don't we, you know, get it back again? Let's do it. And as of 2001, Gary Ross had signed on to write and produce the remake with his father, Arthur Ross, which was one of the original writers. It got as far as that, never went beyond that. 2002, Guillermo del Toro says, I want to remake this, because everyone loves this movie and they want to make their own version. Del Toro was probably the one that got the closest. The problem is, by the it just got tied up in legal stuff, and then he just made Shape of Water anyway, which made his own version of it, you know, kind of thing. And Shape of Water went on to, you know, win the Academy Award and whatever kind of thing, which is crazy, right? So Shape of Water, which is it's not exactly Creature from Black Lagoon, but it's very close in some of the aspects of it. That would, if that was what Creature from Black Lagoon became, like, you imagine, like, that level. I mean, I understand it's like, you know, a decade later he was making it. But if Peter Jackson, not Peter Jackson, Guillermo del Toro, who was on the cutting edge of always having the best special effects in his movies, he could have made a Creature from Black Lagoon. Okay, we could have seen that. I mean, Carpenter in the 90s, you would have got something that would have been man in a suit still. It would not have been all CGI or anything.
Right.
And Del Toro is always about man in a suit when possible.
Yeah, it was like Predator.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know what I remember about all of this is that at this point, not that it was all social media, but there was rumors about this. That, and we were getting, I remember you and your brother and I, we were really said, oh man, they're going to make this thing. We were looking forward to it.
CineFantastique kept talking about it over and over, and it kept attaching name brand directors. It's not like, you know, Joe Schmo's making this. It's like when it's talking about, you know, Carpenter and they're talking and Peter Jackson and Universal wants this to be a, you know, their summer blockbuster. You're like, yes, this is what we want to see.
It just never, this never materialized.
Yeah. So there was obviously in 2005, they actually got as far as starting to get scripts together. But then the writers, the Screenwriters Guild strike in 07 to 08 put a lot of that on ice and kind of thing that slowed it down. And then the guy who was attached to that, which is Breck Eisner, decided to shift from doing The Creature to making the remake of The Crazies, which, if you've never seen the remake of The Crazies, it's awesome. And then wind up finishing that because that got pushed ahead. They spent 6 months working on a new incarnation of the Gillman with one of the guys who was the designer, Mark McCherry, who worked on Jurassic Park and is David Jones's personal designer. They wanted to keep it faithful, but never got there. In 2009, again, a lot of the same names attached to it, but it was eventually abandoned by 2011. In 2012, they announced the remake was in production simply by the title The Black Lagoon rather than The Creature from Black Lagoon. The film was expected to hit theaters in 2014, but ultimately was canceled. In 2020, Universal started considering a remake with Scarlett Johansson and Chris Evans, but then, you know, COVID, so that killed that. So from there, there's talk of a reboot also, but the problem is none of these things ever get off the ground. And Shape of Water coming out kind of already takes Guillermo del Toro out of the mix. You never say never, because he loves this movie so much that he could come and make a remake of it. But every year that passes, the further we get away, we're now 70 years from the original. It gets harder and harder to remake this movie, because I think you have to make a period piece, right? As we get further and further technology wise, the world, as we know, is getting smaller and smaller, so to speak, right? You can't make this movie in 2024. You can't make it with modern technology. This movie needs to be, you know, just like, no cell phones, no cameras, no nothing. Like, just the whole point is they can't get a picture of it, right?
Just like Jackson's Cog, you know, it had to be 1933.
Yeah.
Not 2000.
But even Skull Island had to be the 1970s to make, because you're not showing Kong as this human, he's still growing. Right now, the Kong we have in the movies is the Kong, obviously, from Skull Island. But it had to take, you couldn't have a fully formed, grown-up Kong, and a complete adult, if that's what's going to be in 1976. And then now, you know, 40-something years later, he's now fighting Godzilla. He would be ancient.
Yeah. One of the things that really put the kibosh on this was Universal decided to bring back all of their creatures. And what was the first one that came out?
So they made the Mummy. They're talking about making the Dark Universe. They still want to do this. So
yeah, but the point was that the movie that they brought out was a bomb, and so now they weren't making any money. And if you're spending, you know, $50 to $100 million on a movie, probably even more at that time, and your return on investment of the first one you did was underwhelming.
Okay. So, but the problem is the mummies that came out, Stephen Sommers, the mummies.
Well, yeah,
but they tried to capitalize on that with Van Helsing, and that tanked.
Right.
Because they made Dracula more effeminate than he should have been. Frankenstein's yapping the whole time. Right. Like, it just didn't work. Then they tried it again with the Wolfman, Benicio del Toro and Anthony Hopkins, the Wolfman. And while that movie has some good parts to it, it was underwhelming. So then they tried it again, but now instead of going with, like, let's just go straight horror, they tried to make it more of an actioner with, and not the way the Mummy was. And I mean, Stephen Sommers, the Mummy movies are action movies. They are just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. They're adventure movies, but they tried to make it more thrilling with, and having Tom Cruise's name attached to it didn't have enough drawing power to keep people going back. Because when you watch the Mummy, right, it's, you don't like Tom Cruise. You don't like his character in it, right? There's nothing in there that is overly, you know, inventive. I mean, they make the mummy of a woman, which is fine. But, like, the problem is you're kind of telling the mummy, Karloff's the mummy, which I've always called the Egyptian. You're basically telling that story, but then trying to tie in the mummy sequels without paying off the first story. And then you have Russell Crowe there as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but then those effects look poor. It just didn't work. And the problem was, you had a chance if Van Helsing had hit and you had done Van Helsing well. And it's not, it just, Van Helsing was just too convoluted. it was such a, like, it was just, it was like, let's jam it all in one movie. And you can't jam it all in one movie. You have to kind of build it. It's, as much as I know people are getting tired of Marvel and whatever and all the different Marvel movies, the first one in each series introduces all the characters. Then you jam them all together. You can't have the monster rally. You can't have House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein until you've had Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman. You can't have them all there. And now there's talk of bringing back the Dark Universe again, because Universal is opening its Dark Universe land, which looks phenomenal. But the nice part is, since there are no movies tied to it directly, they can make those rides however they need to make those rides. You don't have to make it look like Benicio del Toro. You don't have to make it look like Tom Cruise. You don't have to make it look like whatever, because that could lead to issues of like rights and who, you know, whatever. So, but that's part of the problem. The Dark Universe, which existed, which Universal created back in the 30s and carried it right through to the 50s and whatever, it worked well. Frankenstein and the Wolfman fight each other. Like, they're all together in that, in the rally movies. They're all together in the, in Emma Costello Meet Frankenstein, but you didn't have to shoehorn them all into the same movie right away. You let them build, because no one thought about doing that. It wasn't like, well, let's make Frankenstein. Let's stick Dracula in it. No. I mean, they didn't even use Bela Lugosi, for crying out loud, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, at the end of the day, a remake of The Creature is going to be very hard. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Stan Winston's team, in this case being Matt Rose and Steve Wang, already had made a creature in Monster Squad that is far superior to what most people would come up with. And there is no way that you are going to CGI up a creature that's going to look better than the creature from Monster Squad.
Right.
The one in Monster Squad, obviously they had to change it up and whatever. And the creature is not on the screen a ton in Monster Squad. But it is one of the most memorable ones. People remember the creature from that movie. They remember a bunch of other things in there too. But like, the whole point is the creature, that his visage, the way he looks, and he's only in the movie a very short amount of time. He is one of the most memorable parts of that movie. And that, you know, really pays homage to what Matt Rose and Steve Wang were doing. They, as two young kids, because they were the quote unquote kids of the group, they were told to make that. And they would go on to work, obviously, on Predator and stuff like that, because that was Stan Winston's studio. But to make the suit so that it didn't overlap, so it didn't bend, it didn't fold, it really paid a lot of homage to the original Creature from Black Lagoon, which we have here, which Bud Westmore gets credit for, although we know he was only head of the department. It was really Julie, I forgot her last name. I just blanked on her last name, who actually created the creature. So,
yeah, you know. The thing is, if we don't ever get a remake of The Creature from the Black Lagoon, so be it.
Yep.
The one of the problems with remakes is that if you're trying to compare it to a classic, and you always see that it doesn't work, I'd say more than 25% of the time. A remake of any classic movie is always going to be compared to the original. And it works sometimes, one of the times that it did work.
Millicent Patrick, that's her name. It's one of the things, she never got credit ever for it. Bud Westmore got all the credit for this. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the Jackson's Kong stands up to the original because of the way the period piece and the special effects, which were superior to the first one. But 99 times out of 100, you wind up saying, geez, I like the other one better. This one here, if you've never seen it, I mean, I can't imagine that. Well, again,
no, there's a lot of people who don't watch anything.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I mean, you've got to watch it. The storyline moves quickly. It is literate. It makes sense. The creature doesn't make sense, because that he wouldn't be there wouldn't be one like that. But if you accept the fact that there is a creature in the Amazonian jungles that is amphibian and also can walk on land, it's just an entertaining 80 minutes.
Yeah.
And when it's over, you say, that was a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
And you know, that too many times, I'll give you an example. The beginning of the end with the...
It's a very different movie, Dad.
No, yes.
You could make 20 being from being in the end for what they probably spent on this movie.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Is that all these movies came out in the same time period, you know, in the mid to late 50s. And yet you've got a movie like this, which is high quality, and then you've got a movie like...
Well, but that's the difference between Universal, AIP, and things like that. Yeah, this is why when we watch AIP movies, like when you have a movie that they make and they're like, well, what's the creature look like? It's just in superimposed bugs on the screen, right? But they had to because they didn't have any money.
Yeah, no, but that's what I mean. So, but all of those movies are trying to capitalize on the better movies that were made.
Yeah.
Because, hey, we can make a cockroach.
But they still do that. They still make, if as soon as one shark movie's coming out, there's a million shark movies, right? Kind of thing. But that's always going to be the case with that. But the problem is the creature from Black Lagoon. There are other movies that ape off of it kind of thing and use the same idea. But the problem is the main difference is it's very hard to shoot underwater somebody in a suit and not have them drowned. Right, kind of thing. So that's why the creature remake or creature ripoffs and stuff were fewer and far between, especially when they're actually in the water. One of the most famous ones, obviously, we mentioned Monster Squad, Humanoids from the Deep actually did a lot of it, and that's Corman. But that's completely different movie. I mean, like that is just like the creatures in Humanoids from the Deep, like a lot of that takes place in like surf and whatever. It's not a lot of underwater stuff because it's really hard to shoot that. But he said, okay, well, let's hide the negative and accentuate the positive. And his positive was a lot of bare breasts and, you know, women getting attacked. And then you have the end scene where all the humanoids attack the carnival or whatever. I guess it's a carnival, right? There's way more action and blood than you would get in a lot of other movies. But you don't need that if your story's solid. But if you are literally making a movie with a whole lot of half-naked women getting attacked and, you know, and trying to get, you know, raped, but basically by these humanoids kind of thing, you're now veering so far from the creature of Black Lagoon, it's unbelievable, right? But it's just taking that idea and moving it there. Anyway, so like I said, I don't know if we're ever going to see it. I think Shape of Water kind of put the nail in that coffin because any movie they make now that would even closely be in this level is going to be compared to Shape of Water as well, which also won the Academy Award. But Shape of Water did the thing that this movie couldn't do, which was take the love story and develop it further, which is why that movie was an Academy Award nominee and winner when it came out in 2017. So, all right, folks, do you remember seeing Creature from Black Lagoon? Do you remember going to 7-Eleven and getting your 3D glasses like Luke and I do to watch it on WPIX? Because it was WPIX back then, Channel 11. And they hyped that thing for weeks. Weeks they hyped it this Saturday night. You're going to see the creature, you know, in 3D. He'll come out in your living room. And the commercials were always like, he'll pop out into your living room. He'll be right there. Oh, make sure that, you know. And then, like, if I remember correctly, I think one of them had a kid with glass on it. Throw water on him. Like, the whole idea that was going to be, like, right in your face. And it wasn't right in your face. But it was still cool to eventually see it in 3D. It would be nice to, you know what, this would be good. And I know some of them are closing, the Alamo draft houses. See this in restored 3D. At the Alamo Draft House, that would be a fun thing on the giant, you know, a big screen, whatever kind of thing. Just be nice to see. They do all kinds of, you know, retrospectives now kind of thing. And it's not just Alamo Draft House that's doing it, but it was them for a long time. But now a lot of movies are doing that. So, and it's 70 years, but I don't think they're going to, I would have heard about it by now, but, maybe at 75 years, they'll do a special thing. Universal might decide there might be, you know, one last dime to squeeze out of the creature. You know, do a release, a special one night engagement, whatever. So, especially since it's now all in 4K. I mean, they've already restored it to 4K. That's an easy put on the screen. Now, I don't know how you do the blue green, the blue red, if they did polarize, but that's because that's why they pay them the big bucks. And I just, you know, talk about these movies on the air. So, all right. So, that about does it for us, folks, here. Obviously, we are moving along here. October is right around the corner. We are looking at a movie that is celebrating another anniversary, not quite 70 years, only 30 years on this one. And it's hard to believe it's 1994's The Crow, which we will talk about to begin October. And then we have a whole bunch of stuff coming up afterwards, especially some anniversary years some bigger anniversary years coming up on some other ones as we go. All right, folks, so like we say here, keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?